Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Plodcast, presented by sportsshoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Plodcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back, guys. This week, we spoke to GB international steeplechaser and Tin Man elite athlete, Jermaine Coleman. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome back, guys. Terrific guest this week, Jermaine Coleman. Look, there's many reasons he's a great guest. Obviously, he's had a terrific season this year. Big breakthrough for him across all disciplines, 339, 744. I mean, Lum's listed him, 827, British champion. On top of that, though, he has a terrific story and he's a very rare athlete in the sense that his career... he's documented in short form YouTube videos, and not just through the good times, but also through the bad as well. And he's probably, well, there's few athletes in the UK who are reported on as much as Jermaine. And I think Tin Man Elite do a terrific job in doing this. They created a huge following, created a sponsorship with Adidas as well. And interestingly, you know, Jermaine could be professional. He is professional, but also works a full-time job as well. He says the lifestyle, he prefers that lifestyle of doing two things. He then has obviously two sources of income as well. So it's a lot of things going for this young man, a lot of interesting stories that Jermaine shared with us as well. And he's just a very open and honest guy, and obviously that reflects in the videos as well. But yeah, I would seriously recommend going and watching it because, you know, he's had his ups and downs in the sport. So is the group. And also, he's an NCAA silver medalist in 3,000 meter steeplechase. So he had a huge career, a huge talent, even before he got to the level he's at now. So we obviously talk about the choices he made leading up to that point and turning professional and the ups and downs along the way as well. Fully based out in America now as well. But look, track season's almost over. I hope you enjoy this episode. It's a terrific one. We're nearing the roads in the cross-country season. I've just come off the back of a beautiful holiday. Probably hence why the voice is a little ropey at the moment. But take care, enjoy your weekend, and we'll catch you next week.
Right, first up, Jermaine, just welcome to the podcast, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, not at all. Obviously, your season's pretty much done and dusted. I don't know if you've got any more races, but have you had a chance to kind of reflect on the year as a whole, I guess?
I did actually. After Euros, after being, you know, after a couple of bevies, after getting knocked out of the heat, when I was pretty, you know, not too happy with that, I was able to take a step back and kind of reflect on the year a little bit and, you know, take the positives from it. Last year was shocking. For me, the year before, you know, really, really bad year, didn't run any PRs in any event. And it was, you know, a transition, you know, got a new coach, a bit of drama with Tin Man. So that kind of got in the way of things. And this year, didn't really crack it in the steeple like I hoped to have done time-wise. But in every other event, you know, massive PRs, starting indoors, you know, making world indoors, running, I think, 8 seconds faster in the 3K. Was massive. And then I think around 13:26 for the 5K, which was a 30-second PB again. So indoors was really, really good. Outdoors opened up the season with a 1500-meter PB, British title. So there was definitely some massive positives in the year. But like any athlete, you know, you could have won an Olympic gold medal. I'm sure Jakob would be sitting here saying there's things that he wished his season went better with. So I'm sat here, just like super motivated for the next year to try and make some big jumps again, hopefully. But I think overall, having had some time to decompress, I'm definitely, I'd say, pleased with the year. Not overly happy, but definitely not disgruntled at all.
Yeah, man. Is it hard to kind of remember those and you know, review your season when you come off the back of Euros and you almost forget about, you know, what you did indoors, like 744 and, you know, 13:26. It's, you know, did you forget about that? And did anyone help you kind of review the year, or was that kind of just you on your own just processing it all?
Definitely hard to forget about it because you go in, as athletes, you have the one track mentality that's the race that's the most important. And I kind of honestly went into Euros naively thinking I could get a medal. honest, that's what I genuinely thought. I thought how training was going, I thought I was ready to knock 10 seconds off my PB, you know, somewhere under 8:20.
I think a medal was up for grabs at Euros, man. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
It was wide open, wasn't it? And I don't think anyone quite, I mean, look, Topi won it. I don't think.
Yeah,
it was,
exactly. Topi's an 8:19 guy. Like, that's that's what I thought I was. So I thought if you're a sub 8:20 guy in any tactical race or any championship race, you're in there for a grabs at that competition. So that was kind of the mentality I was going in at. And then to not make the final, it's obviously you were just absolutely devastated. And then I think what really got, I've got a really good support system around me, coaches, teammates, but most importantly, my wife. And I think she was in Munich with me. And I think she was the one that really helped remind me kind of the year that I had as a whole, because I'm someone that likes to beat myself up a lot and not necessarily take a step back. But she was able to get a hold of me a little quicker than I usually would. I usually go off the rails a little bit and forget about things. So she was able to keep me in check a lot quicker than I typically would have. And yeah, so I was able to, sooner than I would usually do, take a step back, look at the season as a whole, and then just use it as motivation for next year.
Was there any particular reason you kind of pinpointed your Euros performance down to? Like, you obviously won the British champs, and you kind of had was there any reason, or was...
It was jet lag. It's one of those things. I work full time. I've got a full time job here in the States, so I'm not able to take off massive amounts of time going into a championships. And I think the race was Tuesday. It was Tuesday morning. I think we raced, and I flew on Saturday. So I did ended up being like a 14-hour flight with 9 hours of time zone difference, and only giving myself 2 days to acclimate to the new time zone just wasn't enough.
No way, 2 days, Jesus, coming over from America, like, because Europe's another hour as well, so it's an 8-hour time zone.
I think that's what it was. I think that's ultimately what I did. You know, wasn't sleeping great the two nights before, I think it was that a bit run down from the travel. You know, you miss a whole night's sleep. You know, you don't sleep on that you know, the long flight. So missing a night's sleep 3 days before the race doesn't necessarily align for a great race. And British champs had got there a week before. I was able to take a bit more time off into British champs. So I really just think that's what it was. My body just wasn't 100%. And even if you're 1% off in a steeple, 1% is about 8 seconds. And that's the difference between being in the final. And then once you're in the final, it's a different story. And my mindset going into it was, I thought I'd comfortably get through to the final. And then the final was an extra 3 days later. That would have been a full, you know, I would have been fully acclimated and ready to go. So I thought if I could muscle my way through the heat, which I thought I was in good enough shape to do, that I would be able to run, you know, lights out in the final and get that medal. But, you know, things don't go to plan, and you live and you learn, and you look back and you've got to take I've never been in a European final, so I've got to take those prelims a little bit more seriously next time and give it the respect that it deserves and, you know, try and get there earlier.
For sure. It's interesting you say about steeples. I think Matt and I have had loads of conversations all year about how we think the margins in that event are just even smaller than your other distance events when you're slightly off your game. You mentioned how you've achieved on the flat this year and it hasn't quite translated. I think I saw in one of the Tin Man vids that you even said after some of the steeples, oh, maybe I am a steeplechaser. Where's your head at now with that kind of how you're going to translate it in the future, or are you going to stick with a steeple?
Well, seeing that the new world standard is fucking 8:15, I haven't got a clue what I'm going to do, because that's just, you know, ridiculous. But definitely there was a time in the year, I think I ran 8:38 or something in the first race, and I was like, hold on a second, that's not a proper steeple time. I could have run that 4 or 5 years ago comfortably before these super shoes came in and were supposed to be faster. So I was all set for being a 5K runner the next year. Like, that was it. It was already set in stone. I told the coaches I was going to see the season through. And obviously winning the British title gave me a bit more of a, maybe I'll stick to the steeple. But thinking about it, I'm still open to switching events. But I think big mistake that I did this year was I didn't start hurdling until it was about after indoors and not enough. So I made a big mistake. So kind of the plan is right now I'm going to start when I start like running properly, start hurdling early in the season, but target the 5K indoors just because there's no steeples. I have the opportunity to see if I am good enough in the 5K. You know, you've got, one second. You've got the opportunity to go to BU. You know, that's a fast track. Everyone runs really fast there. So target a couple of 5Ks indoors. And, you know, if I have another breakthrough in the 5K, maybe it's something that I, you know, do. But at the same time, I'm continually doing the steeple work so that if I, you know, I'm not a 5K runner, it's an easy transition into the steeple outdoors, because that's how I train now. Kind of how the Tim Mann way of doing it is kind of high mileage, a lot of threshold. And I think it works for the steeple. So I don't think I'll be losing anything targeting the 5K indoors. It's just like a double-headed sword. I can kind of get, you know, both out of the way as long as I'm doing a bit of hurdle work, which isn't going to take too much from, you know, the season.
Yeah, I think you're dead right. I think it's a hard one with the steeplechase, isn't it? Because I think when you're doing it, like someone like yourself, it's easy to kind of look at your ability over 5K, 1500. But, you know, in reality, you're British champion of the steeplechase. You know, would you get near that in the 5K? Would you get near that in the 1500? Do you know what I mean? So it's not a chance to be in, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I thought with the 5K, because I didn't really target it this season. It was like, I just did one just to do one. Yeah, we didn't really do that. And it was like 30, 20, like, don't get me wrong, that's still, you know, 13 seconds off what was the world standard. But I felt like if I was training like a 5K runner, could I have gotten, you know, another chunk off that time? And that's kind of like, if I target it a bit more than I did, because I pretty much train like a 3K guy, then it'd be different. But yeah, absolutely, you're British champion. What are the chances of me beating Mark Scott in a 5K? You know, the guy's run 12:57. That's a whole world apart. So it's like, and Sam, you've got Sam Atkin too, it's only a few seconds after that. So it's like, definitely appreciate, understand that. But I guess at the time I was just like, I've been steepling now since under 15s, under 17. It's been a long time. I was like, well, maybe a new stimulus, a new event might just light a bit of fire in it again and kind of get you excited. And winning the British Champs did that for the steeple in itself. But before that, you know, if I'd gone to British Champs and gotten third or fourth, there's absolutely zero chance I'd be steepling next year.
Right. It's an interesting take. I mean, on that, man, you went to a real good NCAA school for steeplechase. It's almost, I mean, Eastern Kentucky is almost pretty low-key school, isn't it? Like, not many people would have heard of it. But when you look into it, the steeplechase, they had come out of there, multiple NCAA championships. I think, haven't they had, you know, for the past 10 years, someone in the steeple final every year?
Nine of the 10 years, we've had a finalist.
You know, so, and some of those years, well, quite a few of those years, you've medaled as well. So, you know, talk about that, but talk about how hard it's been to kind of really improve off of being a collegian. Because I think, it, you know, when you reach that level 8:30, then it is hard to start running low 8:20s, isn't it? And beyond.
Yeah. It's one of those things where I ran 8:31 in college and you just think, I'm going to be an 8:15, 8:10 guy in a couple of years. And I think what you forget about with the collegiate system is you're almost spoiled. You're a top end pro at that stage in the sense that, you know, all your gear is covered, all your travel's covered, all your nutrition, all your food's covered. Everything's already like, everything's set up for you to be absolutely wicked. You know, like that is in line, and that's how the NCAA system does it. And that's why you see so many fast times out of these collegiate kids. You know, they're running 3:32s, they're running 13:00s, and it's because you're essentially a top end pro. And I think the harsh reality when you come out of college, take a step back, unless you're one of those top end guys that are breaking college records and you're going to come away with a massive fat contract. A lot of people end up not having the same luxuries that you do in college. And it's hard to transition into the real world of, hold on a second, you know, not everything's covered anymore. I've got to figure it out yourself. And it's a bit of a stress. And I think it's a hard transition to continue training with a bit more stress than you do. And, you know, you put more pressure on yourself as a professional athlete because you know your time's limited. You could be in the sport for 2 years, it could be 10 years, depending on how you're doing it. And every year it's a bit more stressful. So I think you add a few more components to it. And I feel like for me, my college years were just stress-free. It was a great time, but a great laugh. You didn't really worry too much about the races because everything was just lining up perfectly. then you go into the pro scene and it's not like that. It's hard to get, it's a lot more politic. It's hard to get into the top end races. There are, you know, there's a lot of, well, if you know him and who's your agent, and it's not the same as the college world. So I think a lot of athletes do struggle transitioning from college to the pro scene, just because it's, yeah, depending on who you are, it's a step down. I feel like that's what it was for me, is, you know, I've jumped around since leaving EKU. I was at Furman Elite, and then I was there for a year, and then I got coached by Helen remotely for a year, and then I joined Tin Man and Tom was the coach for a year. And then after Tom leaving, Joan came in. So within 3 years, I'd changed coaches 4 times, and I just didn't have that same consistency that I had in college, where I had the same coach the whole time that got to know me, because my first couple of years in college were pretty shitty. But then things changed the last couple of years, and I feel like I haven't had 2 years with the same coach yet. And I think that's where I'll take a big leap this next year, having Joan in year two, just getting to know and correcting some of the mistakes. So hopefully I can have a big leap again.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure we'll chat about kind of that Tin Man aspect in a bit. But just before we move on to that, talk to us about your training in college. Like, what was it after kind of having the 2 years that you described as not so great? What made you then compete well after that period of bedding in?
Yeah, so I feel like when you leave college, you go from being relatively a big fish in a small pond to a tiny fish in a massive pond. And you feel like the pressure to do more. So like what you did in college, I used to run this many miles, and this is the time that I'm running workouts. I have to make a massive jump and do way more. And I felt like I didn't understand that the transition from year to year, you don't need to make massive adjustments. You just get a little bit better each year, and it reflects in races. And I feel like coming into the pro world, I felt myself trying to run all my runs at 6 minute pace, running more mileage, trying to really, really push every session. That's something I didn't do in college. You know, you're deliberately held back. You kind of babied a little bit. You know, you don't run high mileage. The workouts are quite easy, but you're going into each race confident and fresh from that, because you think that's great. And then you go to the pro world and you feel like you got to do more. And I feel like that's where, for me personally, things didn't go well, because I was going into each race just completely fried, because I felt like I had to do so much extra because, you know, in college, 8:30 wins you, well, back, you didn't, not anymore, but back then, 8:30 won you a medal. You know, if you broke 8:20, you're the NCAA champion, you're a low 8:30 guy, you're a medalist. You go to the pro world, just to make a team, you've got to be sub 8:20, 8:22. But when Zach did it, you know, was it 8:22 in 2017? That's what you had to do. And that was the year that I came out of college, was in that year, the Doha, London, like championships, where you had to be a low 8:20 guy. And to take a 10-second jump, I felt like I had to do, you know, so much more. And it's just compounding, and it just didn't work out.
Yeah. I want to ask why, kind of, was it your choice to flick between coaches? Obviously, you're Furman Elite and stuff, then Helen. And were these your choices? Were you actively kind of, you say you didn't stay anyone for longer with a year, you know, longer than a year. Was that your decision or theirs?
Yeah, no, it was 100% my decision for every move that I made. About talking bad of, you know, on coaches, Furman just didn't work out for me. I think taking a step back of hindsight, a lot of it was me, immature. You know, you're a 22-year-old kid that thinks you know everything. And just very immature in my approach to the group and the relationship with the coach. But I didn't feel like that I was going to reach the levels that I wanted to reach under Robert. Maybe if I'd given him more time, it would have been different. But at the time, I just didn't feel like it was a great fit. And I made the decision to walk away from really good funding to be unfunded. And moving to Helen, just because I had a really great relationship with Helen. I love Helen as a coach. I think Helen was a great coach. I think it would have worked fantastically if I lived in Preston and had training partners. I think the big thing with Helen, nothing against the coaching, was just I was living in America, she was living in England. I was doing all my sessions on my own. I was doing all my runs on my own. Didn't see my coach, you know, and it just wasn't working for happy. I wasn't happy in the setup that it was in. The coaching was great. I loved the sessions. I was in great shape, but it was just one of those. It was a COVID year when it happened. The Olympics had just gotten cancelled, and I was just kind of going through the motions a little bit of, you know, wanting to have a group. I'd done a training camp in Boulder because I was friends with Aaron Templeton, who's on Tin Man, and Frank Wara, who's on a Roots Running, and because they were at Furman. So I'd gone to do a training camp there while being coached by Helen, and just loved the kind of the dynamic and the team camaraderie of Tin Man and how things were going. And it just kind of, I got a bit of FOMO, to be honest. I just wanted a group again because, you know, what the sport's about. And that was a big change why I left Helen. And then I'm sure we'll take a bigger dive into the whole Tin Man thing. But yeah, the first coach just wasn't going too well. So that was the reason behind, you know, that switch. But yeah, I think all the changes, they're all on me. And I think as an athlete, you like to blame other people other than yourself. And I think I was a little bit just kind of putting blame on coaches for why I wasn't making the improvements that I thought I would see after college. So a little bit, you know, a lot of it was on me too, but they were all my decisions to move.
Hey, you probably won't even realize this, but how hard is to do all of that when you're in America, you're in a different country? You know, you might treat it like home now because you went through the NCAAs and you've been there a while now, but at that point, you know, I think what you did was quite easy to do if you're based in the UK and you're flicking around towns and cities which are a couple of hours apart, but you're kind of almost stranded out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously Kentucky and out Kentucky from EKU to Greenville, South Carolina, that was a 10-hour difference, a 10-hour drive, just going out there, not knowing anybody, not really having any friends. Worked out really well. I ended up making some great friends. And then moving back to Kentucky to be coached by Helen, back 10 hours. And obviously that's where my wife's lived. That's where I live with the family. And then Boulder is a 20-hour drive from where we were. So I've just been just dotting around the US. But I think you just got to, in this sport, you've got a limited time. You've got to bet on yourself, and you've got to try and put yourself in a situation that you think is the best at the time. And I think that every decision I made, I thought was the best for me at the time when I made it. So yeah, it's definitely, no, they were definitely difficult moves, but just because the first move to South Carolina, you know, she was my girlfriend at the time, turned into my fiance. We were doing a long distance relationship. So like there was a strain on that relationship because we don't see each other. We go from seeing each other every day to once a month, once in a little bit. And then, you know, making her move to Boulder, she's never lived outside of Kentucky. So it's not just yourself that you're making these decisions for. The ramifications of all these moves for myself is on her as well. So yeah, I didn't ever take these decisions lightly when I was making them, just because I was thinking of her, not just myself. So that makes it a lot harder for sure.
I think you're right about limited time. You have to make these decisions, you know, you have to dwell on them and make them, you know, make the right decision, but you can't hang around too much, can you? You can't be, like you say, at Furman, if it wasn't working out, you can't wait too long because then, you know, you're missing 2 or 3 years and you don't get that back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You gotta make sure you're making the right decision, but, and not be impulsive. But once you know it's not right, you can't dwell on it. You gotta get yourself out of that situation as fast as you can, just so that you can look, even if it doesn't work out, I can look back and say every decision that I made was for the best with the resources and the knowledge that I had at the time. So I don't regret any of them whatsoever.
And you've like publicly given yourself a deadline as well, I guess, in terms of your career and stuff. And not many athletes do that. So talk about that, because I believe you said that kind of the next Olympic cycle and then that's it for you in terms of trying to compete professionally.
Yeah, for sure. It's, as an athlete, it's one of those things when you've got other goals in life, it's a massive, not a burden, but it's, you haven't got much time for anything else. You know, as a runner, it's like, you don't, that's your life. And, you know, I graduated college in 2018 and the next Olympic cycle, you know, 2024, that's 6 years. It's a long time to, you know, put not just my life on pause. I always, my wife's life on pause too. In the, you know, wanting to have a family, wanting to do things. So I think it's one of those things where you put a deadline on it, and I think you can you hold yourself accountable a little bit more, for me at least, maybe not for everybody else, but I can constantly like check myself, like, hey, am I doing everything to make this last Olympics? Because if I don't, like, missing out on Tokyo, it's like, oh, well, I've got Paris, you know, it's okay, I've got Paris. If I don't make Paris, I failed in my dream of being an Olympian. And I don't want to end my career with that, you know, with that feeling of not, you know, doing what I feel like I should have been able to do. And I believe I should be an Olympian. And so I think for me, giving that somewhat of a deadline kind of puts a bit more pressure, but in a good way, on each year, each season to be as good as it can be. You know, I've never been to a World Outdoors and I've not been to an Olympics. They're the two ones I've not been to in the sport. And the next 2 years, there's both of them. So there's opportunity there to just keep checking boxes, keep making sure that I'm doing everything correctly so that I can, you know, walk away from the sport saying I've been to World Indoors, World Outdoors, European, you know, Outdoors, an Olympian, British champion. I think I can walk away with my head held high if I, you know, succeed in all that.
It's a bold move to put, you know, a time limit on yourself, isn't it? Like, part of me is like, well, if you don't reach your goals, would you still be tempted to carry on?
Maybe.
That's what I mean. But hey, man, look, you're obviously with the Tin Man now. We actually were just speaking, you know, off air a little bit. And, you know, it's almost like I feel like a lot of people in the running circles will actually know you personally. Almost just because of the publicity the Tin Man Group get. You guys do a great job of marketing yourselves. What was that like transitioning to a group? Because as a runner, you're virtually unheard of, aren't you? Even in running circles, people know your name, but they don't know really anything about you. So going from that to, you know, being a Tin Man, and you kind of went into the group when things all started to kick off as well. So talk about that.
Yeah, it's definitely massively different because when you have a team with, I guess, the notoriety that we have, you're not just representing yourself anymore. And it's not like you're representing like a broader circle, like all your actions are reflected on as a team. So going into it, it was a bit difficult at first because, you know, the stuff that you say on podcasts or Instagram posts, you know, have a bit of a greater meaning there. You know, you have to kind of reflect yourself to, like, because we have a large high school audience. So all of a sudden, you know, you try not to post as many swear words, and you know, and I swear a lot, so I fail at that. But, you know, you try and not post as many swear words on your posts and stuff. But yeah, moving to Tin Man, it was really fucking weird because when I was like, you know, I was a fan of Tin Man, so I used to watch all the YouTube videos and stuff, and it seemed like everything was going absolutely perfect. There were buddies on the videos and stuff. And it's like, this is like a dream scenario. And when I'd done the visit, it was like that. And it was great. And then, yeah, so I, when did I get there? I got there middle of summer. And within a couple of weeks, there was just talks about, you know, unrest with the coach and stuff. And there's a few cracks, you know, a few cracks that are forming in the team. And it was just like, hold on a second, this is not what I signed up for, you know? And it was a really, really difficult move because changing groups and coaches, it usually takes a little time to settle, but it's a lot harder to settle when the foundations of the teams are unsettled. So you get into there and no one's happy with the coach, and you soon see why no one's happy with the coach. And for me, I've always found you have to buy into a program and you have to buy into the coach to have any success. That's anyone will say that to you. So you join a team and no one believes in the coach anymore. And I didn't believe in the coach from day one. And it was just a really, really weird, weird time. And when you have the social media presence that we have, everyone's got an opinion. There's always haters. That's just how it is. Everyone loves to shit talk. You know, American high school boys are the most evil set of humanity ever. They are ruthless. They are the biggest keyboard warriors ever. It's ridiculous. Like, British guys, we'll just bully each other in school, but we're not going to get on social media and start calling out people. Americans don't have the ball to high schools don't do it in person, but they just love to absolutely rail us on social media. And it just, with the whole thing of the split with the coach came out, and just for like 3 months, we just nobody posted on Instagram. because if you post, you were just getting DMs constantly.
Right.
It was just like constant just abuse. And it was just a lot of it's just a lot of distractions. And it was just, yeah, it was weird. It was a weird time because you just gotta focus on running. Like, runners have to just focus solely on running. You have to have a single track mentality. And all of a sudden we couldn't just focus on running because we was doing, you know, I have a PR degree from college. So I was helping writing some of the statements on the social media things about the coaching, and we had to deal with all of that and all of the leak. There was a lot of legal stuff behind the scenes that people don't know. And we were legally told not to really tell our side of the story because we don't want to get into a slagging match on social media. So it was like one picture was painted and we had to just kind of sit there and just take it on the chin. And the running world is small, and you had people there that you thought were people that respected you that were jumping on social media, and just like people that you thought were your friends were just like slagging you off. And you're like, hold on a second, you have no idea what's going on. So it was just a really, really tough time for every single one of us, but more so the guys that founded the team, you know, Drew, Sam and Reed, they had to harbor it. And when there's, it was just hard for, you know, when there's a lot of, I guess, distress in the team, there was no team camaraderie for like 5-6 months. So everyone kind of seemed on their own. Everyone was falling out and it was just a big mess, and performances were going terrible. The emergence of West Fly just came up and kicked us while we were down. Everything that could have went wrong for like 5 to 6 months, you know, just went wrong. And it was, you know, Adidas weren't happy with the team because we're getting a lot of negative media to it. And it was just a lot of stress. We had to find a new coach, and it was, oh, fucking hell. It was a nightmare. Absolute nightmare.
Yeah. What was the turning point? Like, can you pinpoint like a moment where you thought, actually, we're on our way out of this now? Because it seems like the past season and obviously the most recent series on YouTube, things are a lot better.
Yeah, big turning point was, let me think. What would it have been? I think it just stopped people. Shelby Houlihan getting popped actually helped us a lot. Because that is, funnily enough, it was like that was in and around the time that we were getting all the shit, and then all of a sudden everything just went on to her. And so we kind of was able to just kind of go under the limelight a little bit, get our heads down. We'd spent a bit more time with the new coach, and kind of everything just kind of died down a little bit. The running world kind of fizzled away from Tin Man and stuff, and it was going in other places. And we were able to just kind of get our heads down a bit. Joan, our coach, and Mark moved to Colorado in that time. So we had a coach that was there. And yeah, I think we're just able to just take a sit down with the team, hash some shit out. Everyone get on the great same page. Everyone kind of realize that why we're doing this, that we're all still friends, that we have the same common goal. And I think we just kind of started a clean slate with the new coach. And it was like almost like a new team again. And I think that was what the turning point was, just that having a few months where nobody was kind of looking at social media, nobody was getting any crap. It was kind of the off season. We were able to kind of reset. And I think that was a big turning point for us, was having that chance to reset, focus on ourselves. And yeah, as a whole, we had a pretty great year, I'd say.
Yeah, I think the problem with the running world is it is relatively small. Like, I know it's a global sport, but especially, you know, I guess the UK and the US is pretty well connected, and that side of the running world is really small. So when you're seeing people maybe give hate or whatever, chances are you probably know them. you might not be friends with them, but you know of them. You'd be like, hold on, man, I've had a chat with this guy, you know, and he's now making an opinion on me. So I think that's why it would be a very hard situation to be in.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. But you said obviously that, you know, the coach, you know, you could see why. Did you go for the team or the coach then? You kind of went because you just wanted to be a part of the team. You didn't care what coaching, what training methods they were doing. You were just wanted to be a part of it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I saw that through the year that this season that I joined, they'd had three of them made the Worlds. Three of them made Doha. Only right, Sam ended up going because Drew got injured and Goose got injured. But Goose beat Stewie Mack to win the Australian title. You know, Drew made the team, Sam made the team. People were running well, and you have three guys making a world team on a, you know, you want to join that. And part of it was, like, obviously, I thought that the coach was obviously really, really good at the time. And he was. Don't get me wrong, he was. When they were running that well, he was really, really good. You don't get three guys to Worlds without being a really, really great coach. So there was definitely a component of it where I thought the coach would be great. But a big part of it was just kind of, I was kind of searching for that college vibe again. That kind of team where, like, you had so much fun, where I thrived in college because I had guys to push me and train with. And that was the big thing, because it came down to, I was talking very heavily with Atlanta Track Club. So it was either Atlanta Track Club or Furman, not Furman, or Tin Man. But I both had offers for both of them. And it was like, what did I want? And I think financially Atlanta would have been better, but I really wanted the training and the team. So Tin Man was the team that I really, really came to. And when it came to, you know, people asking me what my opinion of the coaching situation was when I was making a decision, I was like, look, I'm here for the team. And, you know, whoever we decide to be the coach, I'm on board with, because I feel like coaching's not that hard. You know, it's really, it's people like to overcomplicate things, but everyone's doing the same shit, whether you're American, whether you're British. You're doing some kind of threshold, you're doing some kind of speed work on the track, you're doing a bit of mileage. You know, I feel like any coach can really get, as long as you're getting the fundamentals and the foundations correct, you can make any coach work if you kind of believe in the situation that you're in. And that's kind of how I viewed it. But I didn't, at the time, didn't believe in Tom. So there was a huge disconnect there, because I wasn't bought into the training that the coach was setting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you mentioned the team aspect, and that is the overriding thing. If you watch any of the videos, that is what comes out. And you mentioned yourself that you were a fan before you went. I guess apart from some of the lows in there, has it lived up to that in terms of that team camaraderie?
Yeah, 100%. I think the lows weren't as low as they would have been because you had so many people to rely back on. And, you know, yeah, I can't stress enough how great it is to have a group of guys that you care for about their performance and they care for you, and you get pushed every day in training. You know, there's always somebody better than you at something. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter who you are, there's always on the team, whether you're the best guy at this, there's always, you know, if you're the speed guy, you've got Reed to do the long tempos with. You like to do threshold cage, you've got set. Everyone brings an explosive component to training, and I think that's what really helps us maximize things.
You're telling me you haven't won a workout, Jermaine?
Oh, I've won plenty of workouts.
Yeah, right.
Goodness. That happened.
Talk to us about the situation with Adidas then. What is the setup in terms
of
how it works with contracts and things like that? Because I believe some of the guys are kind of full-time Adidas and they do Tin Man, but you talk us through it.
Yeah, we're an Adidas-funded team. That's the ultimate. So Adidas pays the guys. That's how they pay the guys. We work as Adidas athletes. It's really that simple. Yeah, some of the guys have individual contracts that were kind of done before the team was actually a full team, fully funded team. But it's really simple. You have, you know, we have this exact same obligations of any, you know, individual Adidas athlete. Everywhere you have to wear the gear, you sign a contract. So it's, yeah, in the simplest of terms, it's really, that's what it is. You know, you have to, but you're just representing it yourself as an Adidas athlete. And yeah.
Do you choose to work full time or do you have to?
I wouldn't have to. It depends. It depends what you want from life, I guess. Right. So if you want to be, you know, no, there's no two ways about it. Runners don't make a ton of money. You know, there's occasional few, but runners don't make a ton of money. So if I wanted to be, I guess, have less money, then sure. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't have to do it. But like I said, I'm married. I have, you know, we have things that we want to achieve in our own lives. So I've got, you know, a mortgage, I've got, you know, other things to do. So I think to live a life that I want to live, you know, I like nice things, you know, there's not too much. I like buying nice things, like doing nice things, you know. So I choose to work and I enjoy working and I can fully control my calendar. So I block off time. It works really, really great, other than taking large time off for international travel. You know, other than that, that's the only thing where it's a hindrance, just because normally when I go to meet, you know, I can still work, but with a 9-hour time difference, you know, I'm going to bed when you know, it's prime time work for the US. So I think that's the only hard part of doing that. But I feel like everyone on the team has, no matter what they're making, and some guys are making some big, you know, making quite a lot of money from the sport, has other work, because I think, you know, and other people, you know, don't do it, but I think with running, and I've been full time, it's boring. You know, it's one of those things where you get lost, you kind of lose your identity a little bit. You know, it's just, you just see yourself just as a runner, and there's a lot of, you know, we've all got college degrees, there's a lot of other skills that we want to pursue. And for me, I didn't want to have a huge gap in my resume from 2018. So let's say I do compete until 2024. If I didn't, you know, pursue the career that I wanted to pursue, I'm putting myself at a step back, because that's 6 years, you know, 8 years. Yeah, no, 6 years. 6 years of not working. That's 6 years of other people getting a head start on me in, you know, a more corporate environment. And I didn't want to do that. So I wanted to find something where I was able to stimulate the goals that I had outside of the sport while allowing me to, you know, reach the heights of the sport that I want. And my company is super, super, super supportive of my athletics. Again, like, they let me travel to all these, you know, they let me travel to all these meets multiple times a year. You know, it's just, you don't want to take the piss a little bit. Like, sure, you know, I could have probably flew a bit earlier before Europeans, but then am I taking things for granted because I had British champs that I just flew to the week, you know, before. I've been to multiple meets throughout the season. I went to Serbia indoors. I've had way more time off than all of my, you know, colleagues at work, and I just don't want to be that guy where I'm like, oh, Jermaine's always gone. Is he a really, really good asset to the company? So it's trying to find that balance between, you know, working full time and trying to be a full time athlete.
That's a credit to you. It sounds like it's a perfect setup when you're training away in Boulder. You know, you almost couldn't have it better. But then obviously the only time it is a hindrance is when you're trying to compete on these international stages.
That's the most important thing, it's a tough,
what do you choose, isn't it? I think you're right about, it's interesting you say about kind of that, it's almost like a crucial time in your life, isn't it? To be kind of working when you're what, 23, 24, you know, and beyond. And if you do nothing through that period, you are right. You're 30 and you're looking around and you're going, what company is going to take me seriously?
Yeah, exactly. It's the double-edged sword of being a full-time athlete. You know, I was watching, I think I was on, just scrolling through Instagram the other day, and I think it was Ashton Eaton talking to Cal Merber about feeling lost after retirement. And you hear time and time again, top-end athletes, guy, Olympic champions, because all of a sudden that money's gone. You know, let's say you win Olympics, like, great, you've been doing great for all those years, you might have saved up a ton, but all of a sudden you know you're 33, you know, and you have no career afterwards, and a lot of runners just find themselves being lost. And I just didn't want to put myself in that situation, because it's tough, you know. There's an expiry date on athletics, and you know, you've got more time after the sport than you do in the sport, and it's like trying to find that balance of setting things up. And we're seeing more and more now that people are becoming, you know, social media influencers and doing podcasts and doing trade, you know, doing coaching. And it's great. You're seeing so many top end athletes having other, you know, other things, like loads of people, you know, are doing things now. I think you realize, and there's a lot more of a conversation about life after running, where in the past it was a kind of like a taboo. No, you don't talk about it. It's like, that's what happens. You just figure it out on your own. But it's good now. It's a bit more of an open book where people can share and, you know, tell the stories.
I think not only, like you said, you know, financially, does the running income stop, but when you do just run full time, you're only in that circle. So, and you're not in any other circles in your life because running demands so much. Like your summers are spent traveling. The only time you leave the house is to go training almost, you know, you might socialize, but you're very much in running circles and it's, you get that good balance. And then obviously when you stop, you can't be in that circle because you're not competing. You're not at that level. You're not going training. And I think then, like you said about Ashton Eaton, I think that's when you do feel lost, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a big, big transition. So hopefully I've.
You prepared yourself, mate.
Yeah.
It must take a lot of pressure off as well in terms of like within the season. I know a lot of people who are on kind of these rolling contracts, they talk about potentially if I don't make a team this year, then I can't be pro next year. And if you're used to being full time every single year, like only doing running, then that pressure must be ridiculously like weighted on your shoulders. Whereas obviously for yourself, you're set up aside from that as well, which must be nicer going into races, not worrying about that side of things.
I think that was a big reason why I had the year that I did, because like you got, you know, as an athlete, you target certain races because it's prize money. You know, and those races aren't necessarily the best for the season. And you go into each race thinking, well, if I don't do this and don't get a contract, then how am I going to do next year? And all of a sudden, each race isn't about just performing. It's got a ton of external things, like you mentioned, like financial things. And I think once you take all financial stress out of the sport, it becomes that thing that we all fell in love with. There's a reason why we did it, you know, when we were at high school. There's a reason why we did it at uni, because we actually loved to run. And I think when you take away any other factors that can, you know, inhibit that feeling, you can kind of go back to that nostalgic feeling. I feel like that's what this year was for me. Like every single session, every single race that I went into was just about having fun. And plenty of times I didn't, but at least I didn't have that additional pressure of, well, after the race, well, shit, how am I going to pay rent this month? You know, I was banking on getting top three in this race and making $2,000 to do this. And, you know, it takes away that component for sure, which is massive. Definitely, definitely huge for someone that, you know, isn't making the big six figure contracts in the sport, which are few and far between.
Yeah, man. Before we finish up, then let's just get a little insight on, you've kind of touched on it a little bit, the kind of training you guys do. It is quite volume, you know, threshold based. What'll be like a typical win a week for you then, man?
Typical. So under John, we started a 10-day cycle. So we do a 10-day cycle now. In the winter, I'm a bit of a mileage whore. Not a bit, I'm a total mileage whore. So I'll run it now. Typically, just sweet spot is about 100 miles a week, somewhere in that range. So looking at last winter, typically what we'll do is it'll be like a 20-mile long run. But of that 20-mile long run, it'll be a tempo. So, you know, you'll do the first 5 miles easy. Then we'll just roll straight into like an 8-mile tempo. Then you'll just, you know, you'll cool down for the remaining time. So that's a massive staple that we do. What else does she love? A lot of Ks, a lot of just, you know, 8 to 10 by a K on the track, just, you know, with 45 second rests, just a lot of work where it's, you're not really, it's just threshold. It's everything's just at that threshold capacity where you just feel like you can do more. We experimented a little bit with double sessions. You know, obviously that's the hot thing for everyone to do now, and Jakob slapping everyone around. I think everyone wants to try and figure that out. So yeah, I think that's something that we're actually going to really, really dial into this year for some of the guys that can stay healthier. I did a few this season, you know, something like in the morning I do, you know, 8 by a K, and then in the evening I do 15 by 400. Everything designed just to feel like you could do more, but just really maximizing how much aerobic work that you do. And I think it's really that simple. It's just volume. So a lot of the strength base is just running the 100-mile weeks, trying to tap into a lot of, you know, a lot of threshold work. And yeah, that was it. I think it was quite boring, but we would just kind of rotate between that tempo, Ks, and mile reps. And that's pretty much the three sessions that we would just rotate throughout the whole year. A lot of hills, a lot of hills too, but you know, really nothing fancy. There's nothing fancy about what we do. It's just hard work. You know, that's really what it is. You know, we look back at some of the, you know, Sebco and Ovet and those guys, they just worked hard. You know, there's nothing, you know, they're not doing lactate testing. They're just getting out there and running hard often. And the time that those guys ran faster than the guy, you know, faster than what most guys run right now. And it's, I think we kind of get a little too niche with, you know, double threshold lactate testing, you know, all these heart rate stuff, and, you know, just kind of run from the heart a little bit. So that's what we try and do. And it doesn't always work, but we give it a shot.
Are you fully acclimatized to altitude yet, bud? Do you wake up, go on easy runs? It doesn't faze you now at all. And how do you go to a race now coming from altitude? Is that just an easy transition for you? You can fly in like the day before as well.
I don't even consider running at altitude anymore. It's like the set, so acclimated to, you know, you get a little bit more rest sometimes in harder stuff, but honestly, the sessions that we do very similar to what we do at sea level. Like that's, you know, yeah. So when we go to sea level, it's because Boulder's only 600 meters. So it's not massively high. So it's one of those things where people do sessions here that are just the same at sea level. You just give it a little bit more rest. So that's what I'd say is, you know, you take a little bit more rest in between certain stuff. But for the most part, yeah, no, fully acclimatized. And going into races, there's lots of races this season that I've just gone in there the day before, or just because it's easy, you know. There's a sweet spot. So when you're coming down from altitude, you either get in really, really close, or you kind of give yourself some time to acclimatize. Kind of like jet lag. You either get really close to the race, so your body's not really getting a chance to realize, hold on a second, we're not at what we're used to. Or you give yourself plenty of time for your body to adjust to being at sea level. So we typically go into races right before. And I've played around with it. There's been times I've gone into races like 3 days before, like a bigger one, and it's just not worked out. It's just not felt good. I felt a bit flat. And I think that's just from talking to like scientists about it. It's like, it's how your body is reacting. I think apparently you breathe differently when you're here just because there's less oxygen. So, and it doesn't necessarily translate as well to when you're at sea level. Something like that. So, you know, you see a lot of groups spend a lot of time at altitude. You know, Bauman, the famous, but always going back to altitude just because, you know, you don't want to give your body that much chance to adjust to the sea level.
Yeah. You mentioned the training aspect is quite simple, the training, but what's Joan Hunter like actually as a coach in terms of how she interacts with you guys? Because there's clearly been an increase in performance this year, and it seems like the group's like working really well.
Yeah, it's actually quite ironic. One of the big insults that when she first came, when she's the tin mom, like kind of like really quite funny, but we've actually really embraced that. She really is. It's just like having a mom everywhere. You know, she'll come give you a hug. Oh, what's up, honey? And squeeze your cheeks before a session and stuff. It's like, it's really, it's a bit embarrassing to be honest, but it's at the same time, she's so maternal. She has, I think, 8 kids.
Mm.
Wow. So yes, eight, I believe. I'm not gonna count. I'm just gonna call it 8, maybe 9. And she's just such a loving person who genuinely cares about you as an individual. And I think that is massive. You know, I think when you have a coach that cares about you outside of just the performance and doesn't see you as an athlete, she sees you more as a person. You know, I think that's the big thing, because you know, when things go wrong with a coach, so easy just to blame them and, you know, look at it like that. But when it's more than a superficial level, like she genuinely cares for us and we genuinely care about her, then it's, you know, it means a bit more. And I think that's what I love it. Cause you know, we'd all fall on a sword for Joan, which is massive. And that's the big thing is that, you know, she came in to a really shitty situation. Mm. You know, at the time she got up and moved her whole family to Colorado, partly because her son was in the group, but at the same time, it comes of all of us too. You know, we're also the baggage. She dropped her whole life, moved Virginia to Colorado. It's a long, long way for just to sell the house and move there.
Quite a big culture change as well.
Oh, massive.
A different landscape and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So for her to just do that at the drop of a hat and take us all on and deal with the shit that she had to deal with, and quite frankly not get paid enough to do it. It's massive. So a lot of it is like we feel obliged to do well for her, because we're not just running for ourselves, you know, we're running to kind of put some respect on her name that was kind of not given when she moved out here, given the fact that she was not a professional coach, but her high school team would win national titles after national titles. So it's like, hold on a second, we're going to make people realize that Joan does know how to coach athletes. And it's that big thing where you got to, if you believe in the training and believe in the coach, you'll do so much better. And the moment that slips, it's done. The moment you second guess or start thinking, oh, I don't know if this is the right fit, leave it. But I feel like everybody knows that she is the right fit and the one to guide us into success. And I think that's where it all boils down to. It's just that, we really want to do well for her and for ourselves. It's great. But we also have, her husband's the assistant coach, mm-hmm. and he coached in college, in high school too. And he was a, top end runner himself back in the day. So we have the balance, when we have team meetings, you have Mark, who is a bit of a hot, but sometimes it's crazy because Joan can be the hard ass sometimes and Mark can be the sign of affection. It's like good cop, bad cop, mm-hmm. but it switches all the time. So it's nice because they balance each other out and you get a bit of both always. So I think it's been a good dynamic to have. And I think it's easy when, I think every single person on the team this year PR'd in the main event.
Wow.
And the big thing, teams are usually, top down, like usually the alpha helps with the rest of the team. And there's no hiding that Drew's the alpha on our team. He's the reason why the team was made. And, he had a tough time, and then seeing Drew now run 3:34, I think it's being one of those things where it's like, okay, now we're back. Now we're back in a place where we can be an elite team, because now the top end guys, I don't necessarily consider, while we're an elite team, it's always good to have someone who's super, super elite performing really, really well. It helps attract recruits. It really helps with just the general consensus of the team. And now that everyone's firing on all cylinders, Drew's run 3:34, Sam made a world final, and it's a trickle down effect. So I think it's really working well.
Yeah, for sure. It looks like it's definitely going in that direction. But look, Jermaine, thanks so much for coming on the pod. Appreciate it, and best of luck for next season. Enjoy your break.
Yeah, thank you very much, guys. Appreciate it.